Good evening, folks, and welcome back. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and this looks in hindsight like the week when the war on speech may have actually outpaced the war on the rest of the Bill of Rights. But truly, that war is worldwide, and it isn't just limited to the First Amendment either. The Fourth Amendment is under pretty severe attack, and of course the Second Amendment has been a dead man walking in a gun-free killing zone to boot for a long time now. This week produced a whole lot of stories showing just how bad socialist media has gotten, and why a public-private partnership controlling speech really is such a threat. But ironically, the story that pretty well wraps up the week actually comes from Great Britain, or formerly Great Britain anyway, via one of those idiotic so-called reality TV shows. This one is called Celebrity Big Brother UK. And to kind of help make the point, in a world gone nuts, just to understand what's going on here, you have to pay pretty close attention. This comes from The Federalist, and it says an R&B singer, he goes by the name Genuwine, refused to kiss a man who thinks he's a woman. And now the singer is being labeled transphobic, a growing trend as the transgender community demands not only tolerance, but affirmation, approval, dating rights, and probably subsidies to boot. Oh, wait a minute, they already get that from the U.S. military. Genuwine is a contestant on the show called Celebrity Big Brother UK. He found himself on the receiving end of what, if it was a Me Too claimant, would have been called sexual harassment when the TV housemate and so-called transgendered woman India Willoughby tried to kiss him after he said he wouldn't date a person who self-identifies as trans. So when the singer rejected the unwanted kiss, Willoughby stormed off, and that incited a Twitter rampage against the R&B singer. He's been shunned, called transphobic, and basically outed as being, well, one of those evil male things. Now get this, folks. How dare this guy discriminate against so-called trans women because they claim to be a woman and he doesn't want to kiss them? Ponder the irony, if you will, of some idiot in Hollywood tweeting about how rotten this guy is, and then turning right around and tweeting how brave Oprah and Meryl Streep and all of those other Hollywood black dress-wearing Golden Globers are for daring to say no to the likes of the Harvey Weinsteins of the world. See, if he just came out as a tranny now, they'd probably just soil their little black dresses in confusion. Well, the truth is, folks, given the level of doublethink and outright hypocrisy in Hollywood and obviously in Britain and in most of the United States that gets their news from the waste-stream media, I don't think they even understand the concept of doublethink. They probably don't even see the contradictions here. And therein lies the really big rub. So let's step back a little bit and talk about the reasons why some of the things that we've seen in the socialist media this week made this all but inevitable, because it seems to have been planned to boot. Starting with a report that I did on Thursday about a new video from James O'Keefe of Project Veritas. I'm sure I can't do it justice in just a few minutes, so I encourage folks to check it out online, but we can at least do enough of an introduction here so you'll have the understanding of why it's important to go watch. It's all about the practice of shadow banning, which Twitter pretty much admits they're doing. They're creating algorithms that can censor certain ideas. And if you agree there's a certain amount of double-mindedness or outright schizophrenia in an organization that claims to be about free speech, censoring that with which they do not agree, we're on the same page. The first clip features former Twitter software engineer Abhinav Vadrevu explaining how and why Twitter shadow bans certain users. Quote, "Our strategy is to shadow ban, so you have ultimate control. The idea of a shadow ban is that you ban someone, but they don't know they've been banned, because they keep posting, but no one sees their content." So, he continues, they just think that no one is engaging with their content, when in reality, no one is seeing it. Isn't that special? And yeah, he evidently feels compelled to throw in, "I don't know if Twitter does this anymore," unquote. But I think we can all make a guess on that score. But it's Olinda Hassan, a policy manager for Twitter's trust and safety team, I kid you not, who explained at a holiday party that the development of a system of downranking, what she called shitty people, is in the works. Quote, Yeah, that's something we're working on. It's something we're working on. We're trying to get these shitty people to not show up. It's a product thing we're working on right now. Unquote. Furthermore, Twitter content review agent Mo Noor explained Twitter doesn't have an official written policy, that would be too easy for people to ferret out, don't you know, that targets conservatives, but instead they were following what were referred to as unwritten rules from the top. We're in San Francisco, in California, he said, very liberal, a very blue state. I mean, as a company, you can't really say, because it would make you look bad, but behind closed doors there are lots of rules. There was, I would say, Twitter was probably about 90% anti-Trump, maybe 99% anti-Trump, unquote. Another Twittercrit, Pranay Singh, revealed just how creepy Twitter can be by digging into your profile and conversation history to determine whether or not you're a redneck or a conservative or a Republican and therefore worthy of being banned. Quote, yeah, you look for Trump or America, and you have like 5,000 keywords to describe a redneck. Then you look and parse all the messages, the pictures, and you look for stuff that matches that stuff. And then when asked if the majority of the algorithms were targeted against conservatives or liberals, Singh said, I would say majority of it are for Republicans, unquote. The rest of the story goes into detail, showing how the tweets themselves don't actually disappear, just the retweets and the responses. Politically active former money manager Ed Dowd caught Twitter doing this as far back as March of 2017, who noticed his retweets disappearing and followers unfollowing, especially during the middle of the night. And who does that, he asked. But the key seems to be, it's just a little at a time, and it's only conservative, so people who matter really don't notice anyway. You know how it works, right?
These things must be done delicately.
Especially if you intend to get away with it this time. Now, the trouble is, they got caught, and they don't seem to care. Oh, they backed down, but they're not done yet, obviously. After the video came out, Twitter didn't just shadow block, they just plain blocked James O'Keefe after his latest video expose about their political censorship started going viral. Before the suspension, O'Keefe was gaining nearly 10,000 Twitter followers a day, said Kit Daniels of Prison Planet. After his actual journalists had caught Twitter engineers on tape bragging about how the social media site, socialist media site, let's make sure we pronounce that correctly, shadow banned various non-liberal viewpoints and was trying to topple President Trump to boot. The suspension, says Daniels, was obviously, well, he says it was likely, but I think it's pretty clear, an attempt by Twitter to bury that news story, exposing their company's practices. But Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey was ultimately bombarded with over 20,000 tweets himself, demanding that he lift O'Keefe's suspension. So for the time being, at least, they've had to back down and have unblocked him. And this follows O'Keefe having said, presumably not on Twitter, quote, Twitter is trying to block our journalism. So let me just kind of summarize all of this part of the stories for today with the concept of good news and bad news. The good news is, yes, O'Keefe is making this public. The bad news is Google and Twitter and Facebook and these others haven't backed down. They're literally just regrouping and doubling down. The fact that O'Keefe was big enough to blow the whistle on them doesn't mean that there aren't going to be a whole lot of other people, not quite so well-known and visible, that will continue to suffer the intended shutdown of what was once called free speech at the hands of these entities that claim to be public when it comes to their services to the general public, as long as the general public is politically correct, but they claim to be private when it suits their purposes. Like when they decide they're going to silence any viewpoints that they don't like, and you can't do anything about it, because they're a monopoly, and they have Big Brother's ear, even though you don't seem to. And we'll follow that up with a story from earlier in the week about the CIA's preferred public-private partner, Alphabet, and of course, Google, and they own YouTube, and YouTube is the one that's been demonetizing various conservative sites, just to show the likes of wealthy alternative media tycoons like Alex Jones that they can still hit them where it hurts, in the pocketbook. In any case, remember the white male engineer, James Damore, who was fired from Google because he was politically incorrect? Their tolerance knows, well, some bounds. Yeah, they're so open-minded they can't handle a white conservative in their midst. Anyway, he's filed a much-anticipated lawsuit against Google, and in the process revealed a number of surprising facts about Google policy, including, and I'm not kidding, folks, Google actually provides internal tools to facilitate blacklisting of politically incorrect employees in their midst. Internal systems and tools allow employees and managers to maintain a blacklist or block list of employees with whom they do not wish to interact. Their name doesn't appear in the company directory, they can't IM one another, and they don't even have to see the other person's post on internal Google social media. Certain conservative commentators, authors, and writers aren't even allowed on Google property. They've got a list there too, but it's secret now. And they tell you this is progressive non-discrimination. Later in the week, the Federalist and Rod Dreher at the American Conservative wrote more on the lawsuit and the revelations therefrom. From physical threats of violence against the now unemployed engineer, but hey, it's okay if you're either Antifa or properly leftist, the fact that Google relies on what's called crowdsourced harassment. Get this. Google encourages employers, says Dreher, to enforce unwritten norms by harassing and ostracizing those who break them, according to the lawsuit, and by allowing employees to create those block lists on their communication systems. Google, quote, relies on crowdsourced harassment and pecking, that's their term, to enforce social norms, including politics, that it feels it cannot write directly into its official policies. And get this, folks. Have you ever heard the term, you'll never work in this town again? Well, once that might have applied to people who rejected the advances of some gay or straight producer in Hollywood. But now it seems to include Silicon Valley, too. Google manager Adam Fletcher wrote in 2015 that he would never hire conservatives that he deemed to hold hostile views. Quote, I will never, ever hire or transfer you onto my team, he wrote, ever. I don't care if you're the perfect fit or technically excellent or whatever. Did you hear that, folks? It would be discrimination if those laws actually applied to leftists. I will actively not work with you, even to the point where your team or product is impacted by this decision. I'll communicate why to your manager if it comes up. You're being blacklisted by people at companies outside of Google, he added. Quote, you might not have been aware of this, but people know, people talk, and there are always social consequences, unquote. Yes, folks, the harassment, the threats are real, but not to worry. As long as you toe the line and are properly leftist, your future looks bright, even if your company may go bankrupt due to incompetence like this. But wait just a darn minute. You know what? Now that I think about it, if we still had a free market, companies like this would go bankrupt. The trouble is, in a socialist, fascist economy where the public-private partnership pays the bills, you don't actually have to make a profit by providing services to customers anymore. If you're on Big Brother's good side, you can act like an unresponsive bureaucracy or a monopoly. But have you noticed how you just don't have any other Big Brother-approved choices when it comes to, say, a smartphone? And if you've got the right connections, you don't even have to worry about being able to sell your products at a profit. Just ask Elon Musk. And when it comes to things like privacy and the Fourth Amendment, remember, if you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. They'll fund you through the back doors. While they use those same back doors, it would seem, to bug, wiretap, harass, and criminally prosecute, as it turns out, those who don't toe the line. And that ought to sound a whole lot like things we've seen before in history. The point is, and I keep coming back to this, the Nazis didn't quite pull it off. But now the technology's better, the government is bigger, and their surveillance is far more pervasive. And if you don't like that, pretty soon you're not going to be able to talk about it on socialist media anyway. So where does this socialist insanity lead? Well, I don't mean to scare you. Maybe I do. Take a look at Hollywood for the answer. I've already alluded to the exhibition of hypocrites on parade in black dresses at the Golden Globes. Your host, of course, was hardly alone in picking up on that. Great piece from Susan Duclos at the All News Pipeline has this headline, Golden Globes and the Sickening Hypocrisy of Celebrity A-Listers Who Knew All About the Hollywood Culture of Sexual Abuse and Child Molesters, but basically didn't do anything except, well, maybe belatedly, tweet a bit. And, of course, pat themselves on the back for their courage in their little black dresses. The so-called prominent actresses, she begins, that made such a show of wearing black to the Golden Globes, such as Oprah Winfrey, Meryl Streep, Angelina Jolie, Ashley, Nasty Woman Judd, and others, supposedly to show their solidarity with the female victims of Hollywood over the sexual assault culture within their industry, all the while reaping the benefits of the Time's Up movement spawned from the Me Too movement. Yet, the women who claimed that they suffered actual assault and rape at the hands of Harvey Weinstein were, arguably, not surprisingly, not even invited to the Golden Globes, nor asked to sign the much-talked-about Time's Up open letter. Who was missing, asked Susan Duclos, the actual victims of assault and rape. We've seen so much hype from the ladies in black at the Golden Globes, says Duclos, women benefiting from the actual assault and rape victims of Weinstein, perhaps especially including Oprah Winfrey, who has liberals fawning over her speech and declaring that she needs to run for president in 2020, well, at least until the pictures of her kissing and loving on Harvey all over the web start showing up in the waste stream, if ever. Oh, and let's not forget Ashley Judd, who's now working on a book deal in the $2 million range and is highly sought after to hit the lecture circuit, but who, while she calls herself a victim, actually admits Harvey never laid a hand on her, yet somehow escaped the career meltdown that claimed so many others. But what we didn't see were those that weren't considered A-listers who have alleged they were actually assaulted and raped. Names like Rose McGowan, Asia Argento, Annabella Sciorra, Mimi Haley, Dominique Hewitt, Natasha Malfi, Lisette Anthony, Lucia Stoller, all of whom claim they were physically assaulted by Weinstein, haven't received any of the headlines associated with the hashtag Time's Up spectacle, and in fact, some claim they weren't even invited to the Golden Globes, and only one of them is listed as a signatory on the open letter from Time's Up via the New York Times. For her part, Rose McGowan, who's been very vocal since before people like Ashley Judd joined the party, calls the whole show of solidarity from people that Hollywood never lifted a finger to stop Weinstein for all the decades he'd been using his position to abuse, rape, and assault actresses. She calls it Hollywood fakery. And that would seem to go double in Hollywood if you're a male victim. Corey Feldman, who courageously reported the names of child sexual abusers in the 1990s to police, just to be ignored then, is still being ignored now. He, of course, wasn't invited to the Golden Globes either. Which brings Susan Duclos around to the top of the A-list, including Meryl Streep, a woman that claims after decades of being on that A-list that she had no idea, shocked, I tell you, that Harvey Weinstein was a serial sexual predator, and yet she knew him well enough to publicly call him God. And I guess we shouldn't forget her act of what Donald Trump Jr. called sickening hypocrisy when she smacked down a 13-year-old child victim of Roman Polanski and managed to give Polanski a standing ovation after that sexual assault on a child was exposed. Nevertheless, Meryl Streep managed to wear black, showing that her shame has some clear limits. But perhaps the biggest hypocrite of all was Oprah, hailed as the perfect presidential candidate for 2020, especially if they can get rid of those embarrassing pictures of her and Harvey. A headline from the UK's Daily Mail summarizes their take on the hypocrisy. They quote singer Seal, who took to Instagram on Wednesday, sharing a shot of Oprah with the disgraced producer at some of those same events, along with the text that says, "When you've been part of the problem for decades, but suddenly they all think you are the solution." Unquote. After that fawning Golden Globe speech, he said, "She's an example of sanctimonious Hollywood." I'm looking at a poster that appeared in the same article, folks. Put together a whole montage, at least 6 photos of Oprah and Harvey in various states of, well, let's just say, in hindsight, embarrassing familiarity, entitled, hashtag, She Knew. And I guess on days like today, it's tough to conclude that Hollywood is merely full of hypocrites. We knew that. No, folks, this is outright schizophrenia. And the real hypocrisy is for these folks to claim that the president isn't the one in full control of his faculties, while the socialist media outlets are working hard behind the scenes to try to ensure that eventually insanity will pass for reality. We did see some good news this week, for which we'll turn first to James Bovard at USA Today. Cliven Bundy FBI debacle, it's headlined, another example of why the feds need to be leashed. And yes, as the subheadline here, the FBI's sordid history of withholding and destroying key evidence deserves a reckoning. The Just Us Department, it begins, was caught in yet another high-profile travesty last month that continues to reverberate throughout western states. On December 20, federal judge Gloria Navarro declared a mistrial in the case against Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy and others after prosecutors were caught doing something they seemed to have thought they could get away with, withholding massive amounts of evidence undermining the federal charges they were trying to railroad those folks into jail on. This is the latest in a long series of federal law enforcement debacles that have spurred vast distrust of Washington, says Bovard. Bundy, he reminds us, 71-year-old Nevadan rancher, and his sons and supporters were involved in an armed standoff with the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, back in 2014. The Bundys have long claimed the feds were on a vendetta against them, and are you sitting down? 3,300 pages of documents that the Just Us Department wrongfully concealed from their lawyers pretty much provides, well, thousands of smoking guns that buttress their case. A whistleblowing memo by BLM Chief Investigator Larry Wooten charges that BLM chose, quote, the most intrusive, oppressive, large-scale, and militaristic trespass cattle seizure possible against Bundy. He also cited a, quote, widespread pattern of bad judgment, lack of discipline, incredible bias, unprofessionalism, and misconduct, as well as likely policy, ethical, and legal violations by BLM officials in the case. Gee, folks, almost sounds like those guys are gunning for an FBI position, doesn't it? BLM agents even bragged about, quote, roughing up Dave Bundy, grinding his face into the ground, and Dave Bundy having little bits of gravel stuck in his face, unquote, while he was videotaping federal agents. And Wooten also added that anti-Mormon prejudice pervaded BLM's crackdown. Furthermore, the feds charged the Bundys with conspiracy in large part because those ranchers summoned militia to help out and defend them after they claimed that FBI snipers had surrounded the ranch. As you probably know by now, Department of Justice lawyers scoffed at that claim in prior trials involving the standoff, but it turns out the newly released documents confirm, yep, they were lying through their teeth, and the Bundys were correct. Snipers were in place prior to the Bundys' call for help. The feds also belatedly turned over multiple threat assessments revealing that the Bundys were not violent nor dangerous, including an FBI analysis which concluded that the BLM was, quote, trying to provoke a conflict, and for crying out loud, they ought to know, with the Bundys. Bovard goes on to regale us with a litany of things that he's covered for years as an investigator of high-profile police state power grabs. From the federal government takedown of Randy Weaver, and among other things, the execution of his wife and his son before that, to the grand jury indictment and railroad trial of the 11 Davidians who survived the 1993 massacre in Waco. But in the latest travesty, Judge Navarro slammed the FBI for withholding key evidence, which, of course, we now know is standard procedure. The do-nothing Attorney General Jeff Sessions says he's going to look into what happened here. What, even more than he has with Hitlery? Says Bovard, if they don't, the Trump administration had better drop any pretense about draining the swamp. But on Monday this week, we finally heard this. Fox News is reporting that the much-compromised Judge Navarro has finally decided to dismiss all charges against rancher Cliven Bundy and three others. And that is indeed good news, and it probably suggests that there really is more going on behind the scenes than most Americans are aware of. Because the Obama appointee and deep state friendly Navarro wouldn't have done that unless somebody was really holding her feet to the fire. The U.S. District Judge cited, quote, flagrant prosecutorial misconduct in her decision to dismiss all charges against rancher Cliven Bundy, two of his sons, and another person, after the embarrassment of the judge finally being forced to declare a mistrial back in December. They couldn't get away with it then, and the fact that she didn't dismiss all the charges immediately was at least suggestive that the fix wasn't completely undermined yet. But since then, of course, the embarrassments to the Department of Justice and the federal bureaus of instigation just keep on piling up. Said the Fox News report, it was only the latest stunning development in the saga of the Nevada rancher and served as a repudiation of the federal government because Navarro was forced to accuse prosecutors of willfully withholding evidence from Bundy's lawyers in violation of the federal Brady Rule. Named after the landmark 1963 Supreme Court case, Brady v. Maryland, which holds that failure to disclose such evidence, sometimes you hear the term exculpatory evidence, meaning it goes to at least show the innocence of the defendant, violates a defendant's right to due process, which is pretty much what we've seen for the entire Bundy episode, if you think about it. So any way you slice it here, I guess you can say it's about time, and hopefully it represents the start of a trend. Maybe justice will actually begin to start breaking out all over. Who knows? But don't hold your breath, and we'll be right back. Welcome back now to the second segment of the 13 January 2018 show. I'm your host, Mark Call. We've been talking largely so far about what I guess you might have to call global schizophrenia. It goes even beyond hypocrisy at this point. George Orwell called it doublethink in his book 1984, and it looks like literally it's been institutionalized. Google, Twitter, Facebook, and so much of the other socialist media has engineered, and even some of their own people have admitted this, one prominent former CEO among them. They've literally undermined by this point the whole concept of what was once called civil discourse or even rational political debate. And of course, so many people have been dumbed down by this point in the public indoctrination centers, aka the school system, that a majority of Americans arguably couldn't recognize a lie while they swallow it whole. So let's kick off this second half with a quick story from the latter part of the week, where President Trump, who you'd think by now would know better since he was a victim of the dreaded Ruskie story and the bogus FISA warrant, based on that utterly discredited dossier and basically based on nothing, nevertheless couldn't bring himself to say, hey, you know what? We ought to try that Fourth Amendment thing as it was actually once written again. You know, the concept of a real warrant based on actual probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation. Instead, he caved to the deep state and ended up more or less, despite some lame criticism, supporting the reauthorization of that FISA abomination, which passed the House. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul has at least said he'll filibuster the unconstitutional abomination when it gets there. But given that both houses have pretty much managed to ignore their oaths in toto to the Constitution for a long time, and only a few senators ever seem to have even read it, you can pretty well guess where this choo-choo train is headed. I really wish Trump had had the integrity and courage to stand up and at least tweet that this kind of Constitution-raping power is an outright invitation to abuse, as his situation should have made clear to anybody that was paying attention. And the problem here is obvious. If they can use these kind of general warrants and unlimited power to threaten and potentially bring down a president, what chance does the average peon out there in flyover country have against the almighty secret state? It is comforting, though, that there are still some well-known left liberals who are willing to tell the truth as well. One of them, top U.S. attorney and longtime Democrat Alan Dershowitz, who lashed out at the far-left so-called psychiatrists that are now attempting Plan O-C, I think we're up to, after the pretty clear failure of Plans A and then B. If you can't rig the election, and then you can't link Trump with the dreaded Ruskies and get rid of him that way, hey, how about the 25th Amendment, claiming he's a nutcase because, you know, he isn't far left like they are. Appearing on Fox and Friends over the weekend, Dershowitz compared these latest leftist progressive tactics to what happened in Soviet Russia, China, and other communist regimes, saying, quote, it's very dangerous. That's what they did in Russia. That's what they did in China. That's what they did in apartheid South Africa. How dare liberals, people on the left, try to undo democracy by accusing a president of being mentally ill without any basis? The 25th Amendment doesn't apply. Everybody knew who Donald Trump was when they elected him. He hasn't changed in office, and this idea of diagnosing him instead of opposing him politically poses an enormous danger to our democracy, unquote. Well, all right, so Dershowitz doesn't necessarily know what form of government we were once at least supposed to have. But at least he's correct, whatever you want to call it. Soviet-style demonization is a far greater threat to elections than anything the dreaded Ruskies ever tried to do, well, outside of Joseph Stalin or Hollywood. And I guess to really bring that point home, we need to turn next to Germany, where they really do seem intent on bringing back some of the most successful Nazi tactics. Your host, from time to time, thinks of these things as another beta test in progress. Spare Us the Thought Police, as the headline summarizing the German paper Bild and their reaction to a new law on January 1st of this year. Germans rage, it continues, as new hate speech law backfires. And as Zero Hedge and Tyler Durden reported recently, in what was at least officially a noble attempt to eliminate online hate speech, yeah sure, and unofficially a devious crackdown on free speech, back on January 1st of this year, Germany passed a new law that forces websites to censor content that is deemed illegal under the new law and have it deleted within 24 hours or less. Achtung. But just hours after the law's passage, it had already backfired when it claimed its first victim, a German satirical magazine's Twitter account, which parodied anti-Muslim comment. And of course, the perfectly predictable outcome, they and others note, so totally unexpected, ha ha, is exactly what they and many others had warned would happen when you try to destroy free speech. And now it's finally dawning on Germany that any time the government gets involved in defining what is allowed and what isn't, especially when it comes to fundamental liberties like free speech, the result is always disaster. According to Germany's top-selling and most popular newspaper, Bild, the new German law is meant to curtail online hate speech and is instead, quote, stifling free speech and making martyrs out of anti-immigrant politicians whose posts are deleted. The law can impose fines of up to 50 million euros, 60 million bucks or so U.S., on sites that fail to remove hate speech promptly, and it threatens the profitability even of such media giants as Twitter and Facebook. Now here, folks, I pause and interject a quick comment. Don't you believe it? They are in league with Big Brother on this score, and essentially what Big Brother is doing is kindly giving the public-private partner here an opportunity to say, see, see, we had to do it to protect you, when in fact it's still one hand washing the other. We've seen it before, and we're going to see even more of it in the months to come. Especially as NSA, the FBI, CIA, Google, Twitter, and the like assess how this beta test in Germany ends up playing out. Oh, and speaking of beta tests, I do want to work this story in quickly somewhere tonight. Venezuela has now become the first country in the world, socialist paradise that it is, to institute a national cryptocurrency. Yeah, that'll fix their problems, and it's another beta test, don't you know? They're going to replace the real eventually with a cryptocurrency based on their petro reserves. And it's going to be called the petro. Isn't that clever? Will beleaguered Venezuelans fall for this one? Any port in a storm? Or will there need to be some tweaks to get people elsewhere to sign up for what's so clearly common? And that's why these beta tests are so important. Which brings me back next to what I'm going to suggest is kind of sort of one of the major themes for this week. Let's call it global schizophrenia. To make the point, we'll start with two stories from Korea and then come a little closer to home. One, Bitcoin tumbles along with some of the other major cryptocurrencies after South Korea has announced a bill that is intended to ban crypto trading on the exchanges, and they've raided the largest of them for tax evasion. We'll come back for the details in just a minute, but wait a minute, there's this story too. Confusion in Korea, it says. The Ministry of Finance has refused to support their cryptocurrency trading ban. So which is it? So here's the follow-up story from Zero Hedge. Overnight, it says, Bitcoin, Ripple, and by now you know some of the names anyway, and the entire crypto sector took a major beating, falling as much as 11%. After South Korea, one of the world's biggest market for cryptocurrencies, said it was drawing up new laws to ban such trading. Specifically, South Korea's Ministry of Justice reaffirmed that it's continuing to draft its cryptocurrency trading closure bill, which has been in the works and really isn't a major surprise, since December the 13th. A little bit later, Reuters reported that in the latest crackdown against the frothy sector, South Korea's largest cryptocurrency exchanges, including BitThumb and CoinOne, were raided by police and tax agencies this week for alleged tax evasion. Authorities had previously said they were inspecting at least six local banks that offer virtual currency accounts to their clients as well. And the real issue, of course, here is taxes and the idea of forcing all traders to trade under their real names because of, you know, money laundering. At least that's the story. And the real irony here is that none of these people are probably even old enough to remember what real money ever was. Hey, I know. Maybe they should all get together and enforce a national cryptocurrency, like Venezuela's pre-testing. And then eventually, of course, we'll have a single one-world global currency, and you'll probably have to have some kind of, I don't know, I guess you could call it a mark, to participate in that wonderful New World Order monetary regime. And the beauty of blockchain is they'll be able to track it all and prohibit where necessary. Well, back to the schizophrenia. Just as things were getting interesting, says Zero Hedge, in the hours after that surprise announcement by the Just Us Ministry, South Korea's Ministry of Strategy and Finance, a key member of that crypto task force, said that it doesn't agree with the, quote, premature statement of the Ministry of Justice about a potential cryptocurrency trading ban. And in a press conference, the minister of that ministry said, we just, quote, do not share the same views as the Ministry of Justice on a potential cryptocurrency exchange ban, unquote. But they look almost sane compared to one of the Senate's biggest nutcases, gun banners, and outright leftist, Dianne Feinstein. Here's the lead-in for that story that came out midweek, which says, just 4 days after two GOP senators asked the Department of Just Us to launch a criminal probe into Christopher Steele, the ex-MI6 British spy who was the author of the bogus Trump dossier, and which, according to many, served as the basis for the bogus Russia collusion probe, as well as the bogus FISA warrants to tap the incoming administration, on Tuesday afternoon, Senator Dianne Feinstein circumvented her Republican colleagues on the Senate Judiciary Committee and unilaterally, and some might even say criminally, released the full 312-page transcript of the committee's closed-door interview with Glenn Simpson, former journalist and co-founder of Fusion GPS, which commissioned that infamous so-called dossier about connections with the dreaded Ruskies. The unexpected release, says Zero Hedge's coverage, which came after a tense back and forth between Republicans and Democrats over what to do with the transcript of Simpson's interview, follows Fusion GPS's demand last week that the full transcript be released, sparking a fight with the chairman of the committee, Chuck Grassley of Iowa, who was standing in the way of it. And by the way, folks, just so you understand the background here, the whole point is, if you have other people that are looking to coordinate their testimony so they can get their lies straight, that's the reason why these testimonies are kept secret. Other witnesses in various trials aren't allowed to hear the testimony of those who may or may not be saying the same thing they are on the stand. So, arguably, what Dianne Feinstein did amounts to a blatant attempt, even a felonious one, well, for mere peons anyway, not so much if you're above the law, to obstruct justice and reveal to the co-conspirators exactly which lies they'd better get on board with. Said a furious Chairman Grassley, he was totally confounded, quote, that Senator Feinstein would unilaterally release a transcript of a witness interview in the middle of an ongoing investigation, adding, her action undermines the integrity of the committee's oversight work and jeopardizes its ability to secure candid, voluntary testimony relating to the independent recollections of future witnesses, unquote, which is, of course, the point of having the testimony be behind closed doors and evidently the point of what Feinstein is trying to get away with here, said Sean Davis of The Federalist. At the demand of Fusion GPS, the senator put Fusion GPS's testimony on our website in the interest of transparency, yeah, sure, while redacting the names of Fusion's partners. Amazing, he said, adding, in a later tweet, even though the interview was unclassified, the transcript released by Feinstein redacts the names of Fusion GPS's partners and the names of federal officials contacted by Christopher Steele. And furthermore, he said, it's almost like Fusion GPS was more interested in aligning future DOJ witness testimony with its own claims than it was with actual transparency, unquote. And gee, that's a surprise, isn't it? On to the hypocrisy and outright schizophrenia in this case. Because today, and I gotta admit, I love the Zero Hedge headline here, Feinstein admits she was mentally unstable when she released that Fusion GPS transcript. And here's how they begin the irony here. Amid all the 25th Amendment malarkey being thrown at the president, you know, he's unstable and not fit to govern, it's downright ironic that Democrat Senator from California, Dianne Feinstein, admitted a bad cold may have impaired her mental faculties and caused her to do that, you know, little faux pas of releasing Fusion GPS founder Glenn Simpson's testimony. And that's the second excuse from Feinstein for her actions that so enraged the committee chairman, Senator Chuck Grassley. They note that they had covered her previous excuse, saying she admitted and then retracted that she had been pressured to release the transcripts, which is probably a lot closer to the truth, although it is admittedly pretty easy to believe she was just feeling a little bit insane. Kind of reminds me of something from my days as a corporate wage slave, when we used to joke about taking a mental health day and going skiing because, you know, I felt like calling in crazy. The difference is we were only kidding, and I'm pretty sure she's lying. Remember, folks, this is a woman that put her hand on the Bible and swore to preserve, protect, and defend a constitution that she's worked her entire career to destroy from the Bill of Rights on down. At least the hypocrisy here is nothing new. She doesn't like the idea of you peons being able to keep and bear arms, but of course she has a concealed carry permit because she's better than the folks that she represents. Even though occasionally she does admit she feels a bit unstable. So we move on from the kind of schizophrenia that tells us a whole lot about the real state of the Union. Perhaps it's funny when it should be embarrassing and downright humiliating, to the next phase where it's downright dangerous and should remind us, if we've studied history, what's probably coming next. And maybe this article from J.D. Hayes at Natural News ought to come with a warning. Most of you are used to the fact that your host is not politically correct, because the truth almost never is. But sometimes it can get to be so in your face that it's pretty tough to talk about, even when it's beyond obvious. This is a case in point. The leftist-dominated popular culture, begins Hayes, has a new boogeyman. Yes, white people. This was plainly evident again recently after People magazine dared to name a white guy as the latest sexiest man alive. How dare they? But hey, it didn't go unnoticed. Gregory Hood at the UNS Review penned the following. Quote, "For the mainstream media, it was a bona fide crisis. Blake Shelton, a European-American country singer and the host of The Voice, whom I'd never heard of until yesterday morning, was named People magazine's sexiest man in the world. The result, he said, was outrage." He then went on to note that Marlo Stern, writing at the Daily Beast, claimed that People, that would be, I guess, other people, real people, politically correct people, are justifiably in, quote, "an uproar, given Mr. Shelton's history of homophobic and racist comments." And he went on to say that many on social media are blasting the magazine's decision, calling upon Mr. Shelton's past tweets that have been labeled, that's the key, labeled, it doesn't matter if they really are or not, they've been labeled as racist, misogynistic, and homophobic, unquote, he told Fox News. Okay, well, says J.D. Hayes, the fact that the waste stream is hyper-focused on this kind of tripe isn't anything new. And the fact that Shelton has often jokingly made references to so-called alternative lifestyles is problematic only for the most left-wing of kooks, none of whom will ever be accused of having a sense of humor. But the key is, most of the additional criticism of Shelton was focused on his whiteness. Hood went on to say, Gabriel Bell at Salon called it a problematic pick because it was a reinforcement and celebration of sometimes toxic cisgender male sexuality. I kid you not, folks. How's that for a bunch of tripe masquerading as highfalutin pseudo-intellectual wordsmithing? The elevation of an underwhelming white man to a position of popular acclaim, the ignoring of people of color, and various other perceived sins. Others made similar claims, some tied in their criticism of Shelton's race to, quote, "Trump's America," an insinuation that, of course, Trump is a bigoted racist as well because, you know, he's white. And I guess to add insult to injury, he's male as well, despite the obvious lack of any evidence to the truth of that assertion. Now, make no mistake, says Hayes, all of this white shaming is as purposeful as it is problematic. And here's why. By objectifying white people, which is, of course, what this is, it makes them less in the eyes of others. And when entire races of people are made to feel like they're less than others, what follows next, if we read history, is usually horrifying, like slavery, or worse, extermination. And, of course, it's not unique to Nazi Germany either. And that's not hyperbole, he writes. Because some people have objectified others, slavery has existed, and it existed long before slavery was brought to the American continent. Because Adolf Hitler and his Nazi party objectified Jews, 6 million of them were exterminated in the 1940s, and now the left is openly attempting to objectify whites. Syndicated columnist and former Reagan administration official Paul Craig Roberts discussed this in a recent column. Referring to the UN's review piece by Hood, Roberts said it was a clarion call to white people. Labeling opposition to whites as identity politics, he noted another piece, which appeared as an opinion piece in the Texas State University newspaper, and it literally referred to white DNA as, and I'm quoting, an aberration and an abomination. Quote, whiteness will be over because we want it to be, said the article in the so-called university paper, according to a photograph sent to Fox News by multiple viewers. And when it dies, this piece of racist propaganda went on, there'll be millions of cultural zombies aimlessly wandering across a vastly changed landscape. Unquote. The columnist, Rudy Martinez, also stated that white death will mean liberation for all. And he added that whiteness is, quote, a construct used to perpetuate a system of racist power, and that white people are themselves, quote, an aberration. Now, here's where J.D. Hayes nails it, pointing out correctly and obviously, can you imagine the utter outrage from the assembled mainstream media if a white person had dared to write that black DNA or Hispanic DNA or Asian DNA was similarly an aberration? That person would literally face death on the streets. But it's okay, he writes, to say that white DNA is an aberration, although really, if you step back and think about it, it's not okay. Understand, he concludes, that these people are not writing and saying these things just because they want to be outrageous. What's clear here is they really believe it. And he includes this quote to kind of really put the ribbons on it. A campaign to make sure there are no white celebrities and that white culture is never portrayed positively has the same intent as tearing down statues of white heroes, writes the aforementioned Hood. Appropriately, I think. The political endgame is not hard to imagine. Displacement from the culture is followed by displacement from our nations. Cultural elimination paves the way for physical elimination. Unquote. And folks, if that's not a word to the wise, I'm not sure what is. We do, of course, continue to talk about the coming economic meltdown. I guess that's another word to the wise, but it's one that you've probably heard before and no doubt will continue to hear here again. Let me start the wrap-up for this evening with this story from Graham Summers, chief market strategist for Phoenix Capital Research. Came out on Monday, and he says, basically, we've now entered officially the biggest bubble of all time. Warren Buffett once famously stated his favorite means of valuing stocks was the stock market capitalization to GDP ratio. That was a metric he used when he decided to avoid investing during the infamous tech bubble and meltdown. But Bill King of the King Report notes that based on that metric, stocks are now valued at 144 and a tad more percent of U.S. GDP, surpassing their previous peak set at the absolute top of the tech bubble in March 2000. And we know what happened after that. Yes, Trump has made a major blunder in taking credit for the move, but the Fed and the deep state purveyors of bankster debt needed somebody to blame, and they clearly intended to pin the upcoming bubble collapse on him anyway. But why make it so easy for him? Anyway, Graham Summers says he's called this the everything bubble since 2014. And he still thinks it'll take some time to unfold, but the time to prepare is certainly before the carnage hits. Which brings me to this warning. King World News interviewed Dr. Stephen Leeb over the weekend. He went through an entire litany of interesting things, particularly associated with China, during the year 2017 that are now building to a head. From the Trump-Xi summit meeting at Mar-a-Lago in April, and the saber-rattling over Syria, to Trump's visit to Beijing in November, to the Chinese war on cryptocurrencies. Leeb seems to contend that the bottom line is that China is playing a bit of possum. Maybe their debt load and other economic problems aren't quite as vicious as they may seem. And that certainly would be consistent with Sun Tzu's admonition when it comes to the art of war. But most interesting, of course, is what he says is coming up real soon now. An event that didn't actually happen in 2017, unless you count the news reports that said it was gonna, but is instead due to arrive just after the middle of January, January the 18th to be precise, next week, when the Shanghai Free Trade Zone will begin trading on an oil benchmark. Quote, I've long predicted, said Dr. Lieb, that an initial step on China's path to a reserve currency underpinned by gold would be China's launching of an Eastern oil benchmark. It would begin by being traded in yuan and then supplant the dollar as the currency for oil trading, moving to trade in yuan backed eventually by gold and then to a basket of currencies that includes both yuan and gold. Trading on an oil benchmark in the Shanghai Free Zone is enormously significant, he says, because traders within that zone are permitted, in contrast to elsewhere in China, to take gold out of the country. And it's perhaps the clearest sign yet that China is moving quickly to free itself, unquote, from the almighty U.S. fiat dollar. So I'll close by asking, how many warnings do we need?